The opinions expressed by the host of this program don't necessarily reflect those of Bold Gold Media Group, Thunder 102, its management, staff, and sponsors.
Good evening, everyone. Welcome to Curly's Commentary tonight, and thank you for listening. I'm your host, Steve Curlander, and we have a great hour of discussion coming up for you. Tonight, we'll be discussing the issues surrounding undocumented immigrants, both here locally in Sullivan County and nationwide. The question of reforming our very outdated and ineffective immigration laws continues to make headlines, but in the past few years, and even now, there's been no significant movement to deal with the question. These questions include border security, legalizing the status of what is referred to as the Dream Act children. Those are the children that were brought to this country at a very young age by parents who illegally got into this country. And the controversy stemming around the status of workers who are termed illegal, but play a very important role in our daily lives in this country. Joining me tonight are local immigration attorney and entrepreneur Sergio Savaria and Kartik Krishnair, founder and editor of the Florida Squeeze, which I have and will continue to write for. Kartik is a freelance writer and communications specialist and a longtime political operative in South Florida and Florida politics. Welcome, gentlemen. How are you tonight?
Doing well.
I'm doing quite well, Stephen. Great to be with you.
Okay, I'm gonna first start off with Sergio. Sergio is a local immigration attorney. Can you give a little background on what you do here?
I practice immigration law, and I practice everywhere around the country, including locally. What I do the most is a lot of removal cases and petitioning for family members.
So explain your average clientele. I mean, who comes to you and what do they need?
The majority of my clientele locally is the undocumented immigrants who have to drive without a license. They have to go to work. They have to, no matter what, in this county. And the issue becomes when they first drive without a license, the first time it's an unlicensed operator, just a traffic infraction. Then it becomes that they plead guilty to that. And the next time, because their license was revoked, even though they didn't have a license, it becomes a misdemeanor under an aggravated unlicensed operation. And that leads to the criminal part of it, and then ultimately to possible removal.
So in other words, basically they're driving to work and they get caught. They get caught twice and they're on their way back to their country.
Yes. And that's the problem with programs like Safe Communities that is under Obama. They're supposed to target criminal elements like people who are killing, raping. But in fact, they're catching these sort of people who are farm workers who are working in a factory. They have to go get milk for their child and they're driving without a license. And their cars aren't the best. They're not making the best salaries working where they're working. So a routine traffic stop becomes...
So in terms of economic status, most of them are basically poor people, right?
Most of them work for minimum wage, if not less.
And they're working, though. It's not like they're... Are they collecting welfare?
Most of them don't, because they won't be able to collect welfare. The ones that collect some of those benefits are the children, because they're U.S. citizens. So they're able to get benefits for those children.
What got me started on this topic the other day, I was doing my own gardening, and I basically got crippled from it. And, you know, I thought about all the undocumented workers that do this every day. I mean, I was in admiration of them. And not only that kind of work, but I think basically they're doing work that most Americans don't do. Is that true?
It's completely accurate. It's most of the work that no one will take. I mean, you take cleaning farms, you take doing landscaping. It's hard physical labor that they're used to from their country. And the salary in their country may be $5 a day, $200 a month. So they come here and perform those duties, but they get paid minimum wage.
Now, recently, there was news that there may be some movement in Washington. What is wrong with the immigration law in this country at this point?
The problem with the immigration laws in this country is that they generalize everything. So when you take an immigration law and you say, okay, we're going to target, like I said, making communities safer, you're not targeting the real criminal element. You're actually targeting pretty innocent people who are just going to work, doing things that they have to do, so they're generalized.
Go into a little more detail. I mean, what are they doing on the farms? What are they doing at...
They do everything. I mean, if you have an undocumented worker, they'll do everything, from cleaning toilets to cleaning manure. Whatever you tell them to do, they'll do it.
And are they paying taxes?
Yes, they do pay taxes.
How are they paying taxes?
In a lot of cases, they end up working, and it's actually not under real Social Security. So what they do is they get a tax ID at the end of the year, and they put that information under. They get the tax ID, tax preparer, and then they file, so it goes into that tax ID. Once they become citizens, if they're able to, or if they get gain residency, they take what they put into that tax ID, and they can actually put it towards their real Social Security when they become residents.
Kartik, you're in the state of Florida, right?
Correct.
In the state of Florida, the agricultural economy, the tourist economy down there are totally dependent on undocumented workers. Is that right?
That is correct.
There's been a movement to get undocumented workers either deported or exposed there. And the big agriculture has been the ones that have led the charge against that, right?
Yeah, and there have been aspects of big business. I mean, this is an interesting split. We have several business groups in the state that have not seen eye to eye on this. Florida Chamber, for instance, has been pushing for immigration reform, the Florida Chamber of Commerce. But Associated Industries of Florida, which is a more conservative kind of very pro, and it's seen as a more extreme kind of aligned with conservative Republicans in the state legislature, they have been against any sort of immigration reforms. That's an interesting split even within the business coalition in the state of Florida.
There was a history of workers at one point, I think in the 50s and the 60s, where they were coming in under a certain status and leaving when they were done harvesting the fields down there and harvesting the orange trees and doing that, right? I mean, that subsequently changed, and I think that led to the legal status changing. Is that right?
Correct.
And you know, it's something I think that no one's really talking about. I mean, would you agree with me that these workers are essential to our economy at this point?
There's no question about that. I don't know what happens to Florida's economy if we start hauling workers out of the state or out of the country and deporting them. The idea of self-deportation and all these political things we've heard, it's madness in this state. It was really surprising to see our U.S. senator kind of recant on his position on this issue.
That's Marco Rubio, right?
Yeah, correct. Senator Rubio, our junior senator. It is also very important to understand Florida's demographics and Florida's economy for Republicans out there saying Jeb Bush is extreme on this issue. Jeb Bush is out of step with the grassroots of the Republican Party.
Well, let's talk about that a little bit, and yeah. Serge, join us on this. You know, Jeb Bush recently came out and said, we got to repair this, right?
Right, yeah.
And he's getting crucified by the right wing. And,
right.
You know, it's being portrayed as ruining it might be something that will ruin his chances to become president in the next 2-3 years. You know, in terms of a presidential race. And he sounds like a point of rationality, right?
Yeah, certainly. And I think the other thing about Governor Bush on this is that he dealt with it as governor. He saw the differences in how businesses operated and the potential downfall for businesses if undocumented workers are not allowed to continue to enhance our economy and serve in our workforce. And it's important to also recall that Governor Bush and President George W. Bush, they didn't have this problem with Hispanic voters that the Republican Party has had since the Bush era ended. Jeb Bush did very, very well, both of his runs for governor, retains a lot of that support today. So a lot of the Hispanic voters in the state of Florida, at least according to public opinion polls, who supported Barack Obama in 2008 and 2012, overwhelmingly supported President Obama in 2012. He got over 70% of the Latino / Hispanic vote in the state of Florida. A lot of them are Jeb Bush supporters still. He retains that support, which other Republicans don't retain.
Well, he speaks Spanish, number one. Number two, he's married to a Hispanic woman, right?
Correct.
And you know, he did business in Venezuela at one point during his during his early career. I mean, he's always showed an empathy toward immigrants.
I think he's even couching it in more empathetic terms than the Democrats are. The Democrats are talking about different aspects of the economy. It's interesting, Jeb Bush came out and said, now all these conservatives or people in his party that are saying that these are lawbreakers, this is a minor offense, okay, relatively speaking, as far as lawbreaking. And it's an offense of law. It's an offense about trying to better oneself. It is not breaking the law in order to hurt other people, like so many, like it's being couched by those extremists on the right that are railing against immigration. So Bush actually, at least in his rhetoric, took a position maybe to the left of the Democrats in what he said recently.
in terms of border security, and Serge, jump in on this one. I mean, number one, I think because of the downturn in the economy, we've actually seen a flow back.
Yes, there is.
Have you seen that locally?
Yes, there is. Absolutely.
Tell us about that. I mean,
locally, I saw that a lot of the places that hire some of these people had lost their work personnel. So they actually had to go out.
So you're not as busy as you used to be, in other words.
I am, because regardless of how it's going, it's petitions are being filed for family members, or they're being picked up by somebody. And so you're always busy if you're doing immigration law.
Mm-hmm.
But from a standpoint of how much people can I support if I come to this country and I'm here working, and then all of a sudden I can't find a job, then I have to go back home.
So they go back home.
Yeah.
And how much of a percentage of what they make goes back?
Almost everything.
So in other words, they're living subsistence here, in other words, to support families elsewhere.
That's all it is.
And Kartik, that's a huge number. I mean, if they stop the transfers of money out of this country, it's billions and billions of dollars. That's basically foreign aid to Central America, Latin America, and elsewhere. Right?
The remittances are huge. This is a really important part of the issue that Sergio has brought up. Remittances, if those remittances disappear, then we're in a position where the economy of our neighbors collapses, or potentially collapses. And that's something that, again, the people who are rhetorically railing against immigration and immigrants don't seem to, they can't grasp this basic economic principle.
So it's even more fascinating than that, because you have that money going back home, but you also have Mexicans who are able to get their children. So if they have 10 children in Mexico, they can file taxes here and put them as qualified dependents and get all the benefits, the credits of those children. So they can end up with 10, 20,000. And that's where you see a lot of fraud. You see people who know this, and then they start telling the Mexican people, go and get as many birth certificates as you can, and they get them in trouble.
I mean, if you look at the history of this country, I mean, I know my mother was an immigrant from Poland. She came over, you know, after World War II, after being in a DP camp, and came over, had to learn the language. I think one of the big problems facing modern immigration is this use of Spanish as a primary language, particularly in South Florida, right, Kartik? I mean, I think that's one of the things that...
Yeah.
That riles people up. I mean, is that something? I mean, do you find your clients, Serge, learning to speak English, or is it more important that the children speak English?
It's actually the children that are speaking English, because if you look at any part of society, even like when I went to college, people segregate themselves and go to where they feel the most common interest. So Spanish people would go with Spanish people, blacks would go with blacks, whites, we do it ourselves. So when you have these communities that have a lot of Spanish people, they tend to go to the same place where they all are, so there's no real need to learn the language. So they make it like that upon themselves. But like you said, I came in as an immigrant, and I was running from the civil war in my country.
Where is that?
El Salvador.
Okay, you're from El Salvador.
So during the civil war, my entire family came here. We had to go through the process. We know the fear. So it's very difficult at the same time, because you want to learn, but it's a totally different world, and it's so intimidating. And when you're trying to speak that language and people are laughing at you, it's easier to go to your community and just stay in a safe zone. Okay. So if you're not a child going to school, you're not forced to use it. You're not going to use it.
This is Steve Curlander. I'm talking to Sergio Saveria and Kartik Krishnayer. We're discussing the immigration and various aspects involved with the issues surrounding undocumented workers. We're going to take a break right now, and we'll be right back in a moment.
Animal Hospital of Sullivan County, how may I help you?
This is Spike. I'm not feeling so well. Can I get in to see the vet?
How about tomorrow at 10 a.m.?
Well, that would work, but I have one problem. I don't have a ride.
No problem. Just call Yellow Cab. They will pick you up and get you here for your appointment for free.
Great! See you tomorrow.
Hi, this is Jack Budolowski from the Animal Hospital Sullivan County.
And this is Alan Keston from Yellow Cab.
The Animal Hospital Sullivan County in Ferndale is proud to partner with Yellow Cab to offer a free cab service from Monticello or Liberty. Just call and make your pet an appointment at 845-292-6711.
Then give us a call at Yellow Cab 794-4040 or 794-1120 to schedule your free ride from Monticello or Liberty.
This is a great example of how two great Sullivan County businesses can partner to help out the community, the Animal Hospital Sullivan County
and Yellow Cab, working together to get your pet to the vet.
Is where you do business important to you? Hi, this is Howard Brunson of the M&M Auto Group in Liberty. And although many big car dealerships appear to be similar from the outside, there are certain things that make the M&M Auto Group in Liberty different than those dealerships on the inside. It all starts when you walk into our showroom. From the greeting you receive at the door, to the attention you get from my staff, to the direct involvement of my managers in the process, to my personal thanks for giving us the opportunity to serve you, we just do it differently. But what really makes M&M Auto Group different than the other dealers, especially the bigger towns and city dealers, is our unique commitment to serving our community. You can buy and service your car right here in Sullivan County and know that for your part in buying locally, we will do our part, not only being competitive in our pricing, but by continuing to support local charities and organizations that you, your children, your family, and your friends are part of. The M&M Auto Group, on the phone at 292-3500 or online at mmautogroup.com. At M&M, you're not going to just love buying your next car from us. You're going to feel right at home while doing it. And thank you.
When you want fresh and delicious bagels, what is the first place that comes to mind? The Monticello Bagel Bakery on Broadway in Monticello. The Monticello Bagel Bakery is open 7 days a week, 365 days a year from 4 a.m. to 4 p.m. Stop in for a dozen of their fresh bagels, choose from a variety of cream cheese spreads, order one of their delicious breakfast sandwiches, or enjoy a cold sandwich with fresh homemade chicken or tuna salad and much more. Add a cup of hot coffee to complete your meal. Take advantage of their drive-through window by entering the municipal parking lot on Lakewood Avenue. The Monticello Bagel Bakery is family-owned since 1967 and prides itself on having the best bagels around. Follow them on Facebook or check out their menu at MonticelloBagelBakery.com. Remember to mark your calendar for the 2014 Bagel Festival on Saturday, August 17th on Broadway in Monticello. Fresh bagels every day at the Monticello Bagel Bakery.
The opinions expressed by the host of this program don't necessarily reflect those of Bold Gold Media Group, Thunder 102, its management, staff, and sponsors.
Welcome back to Curly's Commentary on Thunder 102. I'm Steve Curlander. I'm speaking to Sergio Saveria and Kartik Krishnayer. We're talking about the important role that undocumented workers play in our society and some of the problems associated that they incur and how our society is treating and should treat them in terms of maybe changing the immigration laws. We're back. Let's talk about President Obama and immigration. When he took office, he played well with the Hispanic vote. He played well with, you know, the communities that are concerned with immigration. And In fact, he's deported more people than President Bush did at this point. Sergio, you've talked before about how what was a law intended to get rid of major felons who are illegal aliens are now is being used day to day on the streets. Yes. in Sullivan County and probably elsewhere throughout the nation as a device to deport people who are working and contributing to society.
Yes. Safe for Communities is the program, and basically it was to target that criminal element, but it's being used for things like unlicensed operation of a motor vehicle, which in some cases, some of the people that are operating without a New York license actually are professional drivers in their country, but they just have no way of getting a license here. So they drive better than anybody else on the road. They're not being negligent in that sense, but they can't get a license. I've actually had one client who was put in jail for 15 days and then picked up by immigration because he was driving without a license.
Well, in New York, isn't there a way for undocumented workers
no.
to... Wasn't that ever passed? I thought that was
They used to. A long, long time ago, you were able to get the license, and some people still have it from a long time ago.
When you say a long time ago, is that decades ago?
Yes,
or?
Decades. Because now when they go to renew and it goes to ask them for Social Security, they're unable to renew it. So they lose their license.
That was always a very interesting issue to me, whether or not they should be issued driver's licenses in terms of, number one, identifying them, and number, you know, in terms of getting them legitimate help in terms of health and other aspects of our society, and number two, allowing them to drive. And I mean, do they allow them to have insurance? Are they able to get insurance?
No, all those programs don't apply to people who are undocumented.
So
Obamacare and all that doesn't apply.
Kartik, I mean, that's a major issue also, isn't it? In terms of tracking and making sure they were okay and not abused?
Yeah, you would think it is. But again, for some of the people who are not that compassionate about the issue or have just not taken this to another level and thought about this analytically as far as how the impact on society is, it's just a very red meat issue for the base of one of our political parties, right?
But why is Obama deporting more than the prior administration at this point?
That's a very good question. I mean, I think I think Bush was probably better, perhaps better on this issue than Obama was. But the Republican Party has moved away from the position of George W. Bush and Jeb Bush, as we talked about in the last segment, in the last 5 years, as the Tea Party has gained more prominence and then other right-wing elements have gained more prominence.
But those people don't support Obama, but Obama doesn't care about them. I mean, do you think this is vindictive to a certain degree? I mean,
I think it's Obama maybe trying to look tough. I mean, it's just like foreign policy. Look, Democratic presidents tend to be weaker on foreign policy than Republican presidents, or at least that's the perception. So sometimes you see Democratic presidents, we saw it with Kennedy and Johnson and Clinton and now Obama, sometimes they do extreme things to change perception or to appear tougher. The perception would be that Obama is softer on immigrants and wants to naturalize or legalize all millions of undocumented workers, 12 million or 11 million, whatever the estimate is, so that political party can win elections. So sometimes you see kind of a counter-reaction politically. This is a theme in American history that we've had.
Serge, in terms of the community that you deal with, I mean, is Obama pretty popular there, or are they beginning to really resent what he's doing?
The thing is that he did some of the things that he did right before the election. So before the election, he looked great. Some of the case law that came down was very promising, like Chaitis.
What was some of that case law? I mean,
you have the case where ineffective assistance of counsel was going to be no longer a collateral issue for immigration. So people who were represented by legal aid, when they were being represented by legal aid, actually were able to say, okay, I was never advised of the immigration consequences of my case. So now he was ineffective, and now I can go back and retry that case. But later on, after the election, another case came along and said, okay, that case that did that, which was Chaitis, said no longer applies. It doesn't apply retroactively, so you can't go back and say my counselor was ineffective. It only applies going forward. So,
well, was that something that the Attorney General promoted? I mean,
but it's something that happened right before the election, so it makes him look incredible.
Mm-hmm.
And then again, with this DACA, the Deferred Action for Childhood Arrivals, things like that make it seem like, okay, now they're taking action. Let's get behind them and let's push them. But in reality, the president is not going to be able to pass immigration reform by himself, no matter what he promises.
Well, you see a demand among conservatives to basically secure the border. That seems to be their, and I don't think they're totally wrong either, in terms of trying to control things that are going back and forth in the country. But in terms of the immigrant community, are they subsequently pushing for immigration reform too?
They want immigration reform. And the thing that I think I see from them and from myself is that if you put up a wall thinking that you're going to secure it, it's not going to secure it. If you're running from death in your country like we were, we'll walk. We'll climb a wall.
Could you describe your experience? I mean, real quick.
In my country, they were killing everybody. So basically, it was two sides, the guerrilla and then the government. Neither side cared who you really went for. It was more you were imputed a political opinion if you didn't agree with the side that was there. So if they said join the guerrilla and you said no,
you're
with the other side and you're going to get shot. Or if you had children like my father, they would just tell you, I'm going to take all your children. And then they would become soldiers. So we ran away from that. We were actually attacked when my father left.
What part of the country was that?
It's San Miguel, El Salvador.
Mm-hmm.
So one of the poorer sections of it. So they came. They beat my mother severely. They took everything we had. So we'd had to flee to the capital and then start walking from there to this country. So
that's San Salvador?
San Salvador, yeah. Mm-hmm. So when you take a look.
So you literally walked to this country?
Yeah, we rode buses and we walked.
Through
wherever
Mexico?
Everywhere. From El Salvador, Guatemala, going all the way up.
And how old were you at that point?
I was 7.
And any brothers and sisters at that point?
Yes. Almost all. Some of them came before, and then there was my younger sister, who was a year younger than me,
mm-hmm.
an older sister, and my mother were the last four that
but
came.
But you literally walk and rode to what? To the yes. border where? To Arizona?
Texas, I believe.
Do you remember this as a child?
Yes, it was traumatic because everywhere you go, you're scared. When we were crossing, the guy who brings us, called a coyote, he actually tried to rape my mother. So you remember this thing. That's the only memory I have of my childhood, that horrible memory from being attacked over there and then coming here.
And you had to pay these guys too,
yeah,
right?
You pay, I mean, a lot of money. Yeah. A lot of money. And that's one thing that I say, like, if the government realized how much money they could make from things like that and said, okay, we're going to set up a system where you come in like a program like you were.
So you think people in El Salvador would still pay for that,
they
right?
They would pay for it.
They're paying one way or the other anyway.
They would pay for it, and it would be something that you know who's coming in, you know who's going to go out, you know when they have to go out, so you can track them and say, okay, if you move with where your residence is or if you change jobs, you got to report that to us or we'll kick you out.
And, you know, Kartik, one thing I've always thought was unfair was how some immigrants are allowed to come, you know, like the Cubans, for example,
right,
you know, the wet foot, dry foot policy that's specifically crafted for them. And then you hear Sergio's family story where, you know, they've gone through the same political abuse that and I'm not discounting what the Cubans have done. I mean, they've gone through the same brutality and they're doing the same trip. You know, in terms of coming over on the, you know, through the Straits of Florida, but and then you look at the Haitians who just brutalized each other for decades, and they're all treated differently, right?
Yeah, they're all treated differently, and this is actually a contentious point because I think we see people like Sergio's family from the civil wars in the 1980s in Central America, 1970s, 1980s, that have actually left brutal regimes. For political reasons, have been somehow classified as economic refugees, so they're not given legal entry to the United States. We have people who from Cuba who were, they weren't being, I mean, there were human rights violations in Cuba, we know this, but I think they were more economic refugees. They may have been the bourgeois in the country, or they may have been the capitalist class before Castro took over. Terrible thing.
Are you talking about the early generations that came to Florida at this point?
I mean, I'm even talking about some in Mariel. I mean, some were clearly economic refugees, and were classified as political refugees. With Haiti, same story. You know, you've got brutal Duvalier dictatorship, Papa Doc and Davy Doc. You have people fleeing and they're being sent back. They're being said, well, they're economic refugees, even though there's this just brutal dictatorship.
And they were dying when they were, you know, they were being killed when they were returned, right?
Yeah, correct, correct. So the hypocrisy, at least from my perspective, sitting in Florida, the hypocrisy of this immigration policy is when how it's applied to the Caribbean and Central America is just galling, and it's just something that I thought by 2014 would have been solved. I quite frankly thought it was going to be solved in the late 90s. As the Cold War ended, we realized that Cuba wasn't this great geopolitical threat that they made out to be in the 60s and 70s, and we also realized that our neighbors in Central America, places like El Salvador, where Sergio's from, places like Honduras, which had some really horrific things happen, places like Guatemala, where the United States has interfered in their succession of government, that they would be treated the same way as Cuban refugees, and it just hasn't happened. I mean, we're 20 years on from when I thought this policy change would be made, and it hasn't been made, largely for political reasons. Right? I mean, there's no other real explanation for it.
I don't think it's political. I think in terms of politics, I think some that nobody has the backbone to take the first step. To really, I mean, that's why I admired what Jeb Bush said the other day, because at least he's willing to stick his neck out and say things have to change. Now, and it's not only that they have to change, but there's a rationale behind it. Sergio, in terms of, you know, what Kartik just talked about in terms of economic status versus political status, what you deal a lot with that at this point as an immigration lawyer. You have a lot of clients who are claiming that they are political, you know, they should be let in because of political reasons or because they've been threatened, right?
Yeah, they're seeking asylum.
And I was just reading recently that the Chinese community is, you know, there's a crackdown on fraud there in terms of communist China. I mean, are you finding that at all?
I don't deal with China that much, but I know there's a lot of fraud, and especially because with immigration law, you don't have to be an attorney to go in and practice. Sometimes you can be what they call a notario, which is a notary.
In New York?
Anywhere. It's actually federal law. That's why I can practice anywhere in the United States with the area of immigration. So because there's not that requirement, some people just take up opening office and they'll make frivolous asylum claims knowing that they're frivolous, and they don't care because they're collecting the money. They'll promise somebody a green card for $5,000.
You told me a story. Can you tell us, tell our listeners about, you know, locally, what's going
locally
on?
Locally, this happens too. I mean, it's with some religious figures. Sometimes they set up a church and they start saying, okay, now we can help you with your immigration papers because we're someone with good moral character, and we can file an independent representative document with immigration and we can represent you. So they go ahead and file things that aren't supposed to be filed. So if you get granted TPS, you were supposed to be here since it's 99, but there's extensions, and they file during the extension like as if they were here in 99, which they weren't. So all these people land in removal proceedings, and that's it for them. They have no real relief. They're afraid to go after the person who did it because it's someone whose trust and, you know, they go to for worship, and they won't do anything against them.
That's just another form of exploitation, then,
yes,
right?
Yes, absolutely.
I mean, okay, in terms of exploitation, what do you find, who's the greatest exploiter? Is it the employer? Is it the landlord? Is it the people, that the notaries that are
I think it's a lot among their own community. There's some that are somewhat educated that will take advantage of the ones that they know are less educated. But,
and they're still undocumented, though.
Yes, some of them.
So how do they do that? I mean, what do they do?
They, in some cases, they'll take them to somebody who says they're a tax preparer, let's say. And they do exactly what I told you. They'll tell them, get like 10 birth certificates from Mexico. And the person goes and does it because they don't know better. So they come back and deal with the tax preparer. And the person that's a go-between will say, okay, now that you're going to get $20,000 back, I'm going to have to take a piece of it. Or when the check comes, it comes to them because they have a bank account. They keep the money and or give very little to the person that's actually entitled to it.
And they can't go to the police.
They can't. They can't. And they won't because they're afraid. Because of the same reason that I'm saying, if your husband is going to work and all of a sudden he gets picked up and goes to jail, then how are you, as the person filing this tax return, going to go to the police and tell them that someone wronged you? You're afraid.
So they're getting exploited by both the people who they work for and the people who they live with.
Yes.
Well, that's pretty interesting. That's something I didn't know. This is Steve Curlander. We're talking about immigration and undocumented workers and the policies that are in place and need to be changed. We're going to take a break and we'll be right back.
From a block away, I can hear the clickety-clack of her high heels on the wet pavement. I checked my watch. 6:30. No, midnight. I had it on upside down. What's the story? I asked. She looked like the girl from The Exorcist as her head turned in every direction.
It's unbelievable. I've never seen anything like it. I didn't know anyone could do graphics of this sort.
It was obvious she was as nervous as a porcupine in a balloon factory. Spit it out, I demanded. Which she did, right on top of my charcoal gray imitation leather hush puppies. So, what's the big secret? I asked. And in a voice I'll never forget, she replied,
Gaza Graphics, specializing in full-color indoor and outdoor signage, banners, decals, and vehicle graphics, done with friendly customer service and a super-fast turnaround time. Gaza Graphics, now located on 471 North Main Street in Liberty.
Yep, sounded like some new signs. Might not be a bad idea.
Gaza Graphics, working hard to exceed their customers' expectations. Gaza Graphics, now located at 471 North Main Street in Liberty, 845-796-9212. That's 796-9212.
Hey, babe, I feel like some ice cream tonight.
Yeah, so do I. Where are we going to get ice cream besides the supermarket this early in the season?
Didn't you hear? Jay's Sauce Serve on 366 East Broadway, right next to Everyday Apparel, is now open.
Wow, that's great. They have everything. Soft serve, hard ice cream, yogurt, sundae, shakes, and more. My mouth is just watering thinking about it. Mmm.
Uh-huh. And Jay's Soft Serve is owned and operated by Jamie and Bryce from Everyday Apparel. So you know when we get there, we will get excellent customer service.
All right, honey. Round up the kids and let's go to Jay's Soft Serve.
Jay's Soft Serve on East Broadway in Monticello is open 7 days a week from 1 to 8 p.m.
The time for procrastinating is over. You're invited to get in shape the right way at Broadway Fitness. This is the chance you've been waiting for to achieve the look you've been dreaming about. Your dream becomes reality at Broadway Fitness. They offer untouchable boxing, boxing for everyone from kids to women's, and professional boxing training. They have JLS CrossFit, designed to create a state of physical preparedness for any activity. And don't forget classes in Zumba and spinning, as well as a complete line of fitness equipment. They offer modified personal training to fit individual needs. Broadway Fitness, East Broadway in Monticello. Be a part of the program. Call 845-796-6612. 845-796-6612. For as little as $20 a month, you can change the way you look and feel. Day and weekly passes are available. Find them on Facebook. Broadway Fitness, East Broadway in Monticello. Call today and start to get in shape the right way.
The opinions expressed by the host of this program don't necessarily reflect those of Bold Gold Media Group, Thunder 102, its management, staff, and sponsors.
Welcome back to Curly's Commentary. I'm Steve Curlander. We're having a really good discussion tonight about a class of people that contribute greatly to this country and yet are not recognized for that contribution and actually endure an existence that most of us would not appreciate or endure in terms of being exploited, in terms of living on the run all the time. And I, you know, the reason I brought this topic to my show is because I, you know, even here in Sullivan County, when we go to work every day, we're touched by these people, and I think we need to understand their plight and what needs to be done. I'm speaking to Sergio Saveria and Kartik Krishnayer. I just want to get back to the exploitation part that we ended on the last segment. Is there anything that we can do at this point without changing the law?
I think enforcement will be the main thing. So when people think there's no consequence to representing somebody without documents because they won't go against them, I think the DA, anybody, attorney general should be able to go after them, and they do in some cases. But like here upstate, it's less than in the city. In the city, they'll have to go after these people. They'll be able to say, okay, you're committing fraud, you're practicing law without a license, and you're taking these people's money for cases that are frivolous. Here, it's a lot harder. There's not that many groups that will go out and seek these people and say, okay, you have rights. You know, you don't have to be afraid to tell us that you were wronged by somebody who committed fraud against you. You don't have to be afraid to call the police.
That's basically an urban thing, right?
Yeah.
Kartik, I know, you know, I lived in Lake Worth. Do you find down there that because there's a bigger population of immigrants that more people are willing to stand up and fight for the undocumented worker?
Yes, I think there's more of an awareness of it, and there's more activism on the issue. But just as much as that, there is a greater organized anger about any kind of immigration benefits. I'll just relate this story. My wife works for a Republican state representative in Palm Beach County, and calls were running, and we had an immigrant tuition bill that came through the state house about 4 weeks ago, and calls were running basically 10-1 against this bill.
What was the bill's provisions? Basically, they would pay the same tuition as regular students, or they got their tuition paid?
Correct, yeah. The same. They would get to pay in-state tuition because they come through the public school system. In many cases, they have been born in the United States and are American citizens, but they have parents that were undocumented. And Sergio can speak more to this, we have a whole generation of children, Latino children in this country, in modern Florida, that fit that circumstance, where they're actually American citizens, but then even for purposes of reporting, they don't, because their parents are undocumented, they don't want to fill out the paperwork to get for financial aid or any of the things related to college. So this would hopefully alleviate some of that. So anyway, we had this bill in the state house a few weeks ago. It has not been taken up by the state senate. The state senate doesn't seem too keen on it, but it was a priority of the House Speaker, Will Weatherford, and it
a Republican,
it
right? He's a Republican, right?
Yeah. Right. He's a pretty conservative Republican, actually. Yeah. He's more conservative than his counterpart in the Senate, but he realized he's also a young guy, and I think this would be part of his climbing, if you will,
his legacy.
Right. His legacy now, but climbing down the road, because if he wants to run for statewide office 10 years from now, this will look like a bad civil rights bill. All the congressmen who voted poorly on Civil Rights Act of 1964 or Voting Rights Act of 1965, those that, or the Martin Luther King holiday, those things became issues 10, 12 years later when they were running for higher office. It's the same sort of thing here. If you're going to run for higher office, you might have all this organized opposition now, but 10, 12 years from now, it might look like a very racist vote.
We were talking during the break about, how some politicians exploit undocumented workers. I mean, you tell us what's going on down there at this point.
We've had some unfortunate cases of in what Sergio described, people who are not necessarily, they're not licensed to practice law, or they're not trained immigration attorneys, stumbling upon undocumented workers, not stumbling upon people who need their immigration status clarified or fixed. That in the process of Democratic political campaigns and candidates organizing the Latino vote, the Hispanic vote, essentially because Hispanic voters are being canvassed by Democratic candidates or the Democratic Party itself, and they're taking advantage of it, they're collecting money from these poor people, and then they have no ability to produce a green card or P2 visa or anything that that legalizes the status of an undocumented illegal immigrant. So it's very unfortunate. It's quite frankly, it's sickening.
So recently there was news that President Obama called up Representative Cantor, who's the majority leader in the Congress, Eric Cantor, and they supposedly had a discussion on immigration but couldn't get it jump started again. I just want to throw out some solutions at this point and see if they'd work or not. Okay, Serge, do you think if they passed a reformed immigration law where undocumented workers could come here part of the year to work, to harvest the crops, or to work as agricultural workers and be given a track to become American citizens, do you think that would resolve a lot of the issues that they face at this point?
That's the problem with a lot of immigration reform, is that we want to find something like a one-size-fits-all, and it won't fit.
Well, I'm going to discuss various solutions.
Now, that will work for some people, because some people legitimately come and stay for a season and then go back home, and that's their track.
Is that locally here?
Absolutely. There are people that come seasonally because let's say it's warm in the summer, so they'll come in the summer, work all summer, and then leave for the winter and go home to their home.
They don't want to pay the heating bills, right?
They don't want to do that either, but they don't even pay the heating bills, but but that's the thing. Like, some people actually do that, although they'll come for a year and make enough money, let's say, to jumpstart their business in their country, go back home, and when they're doing bad with their business, come back and do it again. So you have those people that it will work for, but then you have others who are going to come in, who are going to meet the love of their life here, and all of a sudden have children. So then you got to have something for them to be able to.
I think one of the big problems also not being discussed are the people who have done it right. In other words, have waited 8-10 years. I mean, you're an immigration lawyer, right? If you want to do it legally, it takes a long time, and it's extremely expensive, right?
My sister has actually taken 12 years. My brother petitioned her, and it's 12 years now.
12 years.
Not come in.
So there's another set. Kartik, I mean, have you seen examples of that in Florida, where that's another example of how unfair the immigration law is? Because it's keeping people who could contribute to our society out of there, who are deciding to follow the law.
The whole thing is galling. I mean, this is a clear example of people not being able to get their heads around this issue, not understand. And look, we have a labor shortage in this country, as you talked about at the beginning. We also have a bit of a brain drain in this country. Let's not kid ourselves. Forever and ever and ever, this country imported the best and brightest minds from around the world. Now this anti-immigration sentiment that's popped up has threatened the hospitality that foreign intellectuals feel when they come to this country. Some intellectuals, some professors, some scientists, some software engineers may feel as immigrants, as people coming from Latin America or coming from Asia, people of color will feel it coming to this country, thinking, "Wow, gosh, this is kind of hostility I'm going to have to deal with." It's very bad.
When I was doing my closings, I would meet various people. One day, I met a man in the aeronautical industry in Palm Beach County who designed jet engines and designed jet planes, and he was employing 30 Russian engineers who lived in Russia. His business model was based upon him being able to just pay them less in the Ukraine and pay them less in Russia instead of bringing them over here. I mean, there was an economy to that. I think he might be hurting right now. I mean, I'm just wondering whether, the because U.S.-Russian relations are now going down the tubes again. But that stood out to me as an example where why not bring them over? You know, bring their families over. I mean, these guys were brilliant engineers. He was telling me that, you know, and he was able to exploit them because he was able to pay 10 cents on the dollar and they were happy to get it.
I think that that's an unfortunate exploitation. We see a lot of that outsourcing of jobs, and that's not good for the U.S. economy. But what I'm specifically talking about is, for example, software engineers in Silicon Valley, professors at universities, things like that, where there's just this economist. There's this feeling that, well, you know, there's so much hostility towards people of a darker skin, which there really isn't. Again, I don't know that we said this tonight. I think it is a lunatic fringe that is concerned about this. I think if you objectively surveyed the majority of people and educated them about the issue, the majority of Anglo, the majority of white people, they believe in some kind of strong immigration reform. And
they believe in immigration, too, as strengthening this country.
Yeah, right. It's part of American culture. It's part of the American ethos. There's just this fringe that now is dominating the debate. And again, they're dominating the Republican Party primary process. That doesn't mean the majority of Republicans feel that way.
And you also see the president, you know, deporting more people. And I think it's not a Republican-Democrat thing. I think it's just a matter.
We have a lot of people on the left that have become knee-jerk isolationists in the last 10 years. You have a lot of people on the left that are associated with labor unions that are scared that Latinos will take the union jobs, and maybe we can't unionize them, so we don't want them here. Yeah, it's on both sides. I think the right is a little more vocal about it, but there's hostility on the left too. Don't make no mistake about it.
You have cities like Bangalore, where you have cities built around engineers and computers, right? In India,
right.
And India is actually building upon the fact that, you know, at one time, a lot of these Indians would come here to work, right? Same thing with China.
Oh, absolutely. No, that's what my frame of reference is, being a first-generation American from Indian parentage who goes back to India once a year or once every 2 years. There are the people who came to the United States, the professional class of Indians, are not coming here anymore. And that's just started in the last 10 years.
And that's bad, right?
That's very bad. That's very bad for the U.S. I mean, it's great for India, but it's terrible for the U.S.
Serge.
Yes.
How would you fix the immigration law problem? Do you think it's one step at a time, one issue at a time? I mean, we discussed various issues tonight, right?
I think you have to attack the fears of people. So if you look at unemployment, if you look at things like that, you have to assure them basically and explain to them how this undocumented immigrants doing certain jobs really doesn't affect them. They don't want those jobs. How dreamers, like he's saying, you know, you're actually wasting a beautiful mind. Some of these dreamers are the top of their class, the best minds that there are. So if you look at each thing and educate the people that you're going to show this law to and get their support in understanding that it's not a generalized thing, that it's amnesty. Amnesty was what creates fear among people. They're going to say everybody gets to come in, even the ones that are the rapists,
So where would you start?
I would start with education. I would start with educating people at like the levels like that we're right now, because when you understand the problem and you're close to the problem, then you have a better grasp. Like if you're close to a farm worker, or like he's talking about Bush and down there, he worked with those people. He worked with those companies that were working with the people. So he understands there's a need.
So is agriculture, I mean, in terms of the sectors of the economy, is it the high tech that we should start reforming? In other words, to start targeting the best and the brightest in other countries to come back here? You know, they come here for school, they should stay here. Is that where we should start, or should we start in terms of the dream? I mean, there's various aspects of it that we could start at.
Yeah, I think if you pass the Dream Act, though, some of the problems at the top of the social strata and the intellectual class that we talked about is solved. I think there's a lack of, there's a feeling that there are elements of American society becoming non-hospitable to immigrants. So if you solve some of these problems with the undocumented workers currently, I think there's a ripple effect. Now, there has to be some sort of fix legislatively at the top of the totem pole also, if you want to call it that. Yes, but I think the symbolism of passing the Dream Act will benefit everybody, every element of American society.
I think the agricultural aspect of it is extremely important at this point in terms of addressing for, my opinion is that it should be addressed first because those are the workers that we need the most. They're part of our food chain. And you know what? I mean, we had in the 50s and the 60s, a system that worked. And I think we need to return to that. And Serge, you represent a lot of agricultural workers, right?
Yes.
So, I mean, I think they're going to be here anyway. I think they're part of our economy, and you know, to resolve their status and to allow them to work toward becoming U.S. citizens, I think that's the starting point.
I would agree because that's also where a lot of the animosity comes in, where they see these workers as taking something that's legitimately theirs, that's their job, but when you actually put it hand in hand, you offer the same job to someone who's Caucasian, they're not going to take it for what that worker's doing it for.
Okay, I think we're going to wrap it up. But I want to mention one thing. Serge is not only an attorney, but he owns a gym in Monticello, which is a great gym. And he's a supporter of Curly's Commentary Radio. I want to thank you for that. Kartik, Kartik's one of my mentors in terms of my writing. He's always been very open in terms of publishing my work, and I really appreciate it. I appreciate you both being on tonight. I think this was a great discussion. And I hope that the listeners enjoyed it and learned something from it. And we look forward to coming back again next week. So this is Steve Curlander on Curly's Commentary. Good night.